Hello again, this is Dolores Cannon with the Metaphysical Hour. And I have a very special guest tonight. Okay, but my guest tonight is PMH Atwater. And she is truly a legend and a wonderful person. And, hello, PMH.
Well, hi! I didn't know I was a legend, but that's okay.
All right, I wanted to say, you know, we go back many, many years.
Oh, I met you ages ago.
Well, I was just thinking about that. The very first time I ever met you was about 14, 15 years ago.
Oh, easy, maybe longer.
And I know it was at the Global Science with Dean
Stonier. Oh, yeah, it's with Dean Stonier. Yeah, that does go back a ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that was the very first conference that I ever had to speak at. And you were already a legend by that time.
Oh, my goodness.
Because I remember I had you up on a pedestal, you know, I was just, you know, you were like an idol. And
oh, my goodness. Hon, I'm just a rascal. That's it.
The what?
I'm a rascal. That's it. You know?
But I remember, you know, you were just like an idol in my eyes. And here I was just getting with my first conference, and I was scared to death. And you were so kind. You went out of your way to make me feel that I could do it, and you gave me inspiration.
Well, I knew you could. I just saw it in you.
But, you know, the first time to get up before an audience that big, and I was really scared, but I never forgot that you were so kind to me that day. And it really helped a lot, and, you know, it got me started anyway. But, you know, for you to take the time to do that to a beginner. Well, you know, we've come a long way since then, haven't we?
Sure, sure. Hey, I live what I know to be true.
Okay, something else I want to say, too, before we get into it. A lot of people know and remember where they were on September the 11th, the day
uh-huh.
of the big event. And we know where we were, don't we?
Sure.
We were both at a conference the few days before in Asheville, I think it was, Asheville, North Carolina.
Right, right. And we were faced with getting out of town that night, and there was a big rainstorm coming, and I was just barely able to make it out on my airplane, on my plane. The flight, because of all the heavy rain, they weren't sure they were going to lift off at all.
Uh-huh.
But I did get home. I knew I had to get home. I did.
Yep.
And the next morning, my oldest daughter called me on the telephone, and she said, "Mother, turn on the TV."
Uh-huh.
So I turned on the TV, and there it was.
Well, that's what I remember. You got out, and I didn't.
Yeah, a lot of people were stuck because of that storm.
Well, I had another talk that next night when you were flying out. I had another
talk. Well, a lot of people didn't get out because of the storm.
Which was right next to Asheville. So I stayed overnight in these people's house. And the next morning we got up, we're getting packed and getting ready to go to the airport, and that's when they said, "Turn on the TV." So we were caught in it. We saw it all happening, and naturally we couldn't get out of there.
Yeah.
So we ended up having to drive all the way back. At least we had a rental car. So that's one thing. I saw you at the INES, you know, the New Age Trade Show in Orlando in February.
That's
and
this
I reminded
year.
You, remember
yeah.
the last time we saw each other?
Right.
Yeah, a lot of people remember where they were on that day. So.
Well, sure. Sure.
Anyway, I've known PMH for a long time, and she has written many, many books. And they're on all kinds of subjects, but it's the same kind of subjects that I'm interested in.
Well, basically, it's the one theme, and that is near-death experiences.
Yeah.
And
no.
from that, I'm able to cover any and all kinds of anomalies and experiences and incidents and brain development and so forth and so on
uh-huh.
because of my research on the near-death experience.
Yeah, because,
Dolores,
you know,
I was one of the original in the field. I began my work in 1978.
Well, you
my research base is, yeah, my research
base. I knew you were established before I came along.
Yeah, I'm one of the originals, and my research base is now considered to be either the largest or one of the largest. It's It's nearly 4,000 adult and child experiencers. I've written 7 books on my findings.
Mm-hmm.
People can find out all about that on my website. It's just myname.com, so it's www.pmhatwater.com.
Yeah.
And they can find out about my 7 books, the various charts, the various papers I've written, and so forth and so on, are also on my website. So I've been very active and very dedicated in that particular genre.
Uh-huh.
What a lot of people don't realize is that in 1977, I died 3 times myself, and each time had a near-death experience, and each was different, although one seemed somehow to lead into the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because of my 3rd near-death experience that I became a researcher.
That's what I was wondering. That started you off, didn't it, then?
Well, it was very specific. I heard a voice speak, and easily a decade before my experience, I had been a teacher of meditation and explorer of altered states of consciousness and so forth and so on.
Uh-huh.
So I was familiar with angel voices and guides and guardians and, all these kinds of spiritual voices that one can hear on the other side or when you're in an altered state. And this voice wasn't like that.
It was
not like any of those voices. It was sort of like every molecule and every cell in the universe just sort of got up and saluted this voice. It was just so awesome. And I considered it to be of God. And the voice, when it spoke, it was very specific, and I'll quote you because it's very short. What it said was, test revelation. You are to do the research. 1 book for each death. End of quote. I was shown what that meant. Books 2 and 3 were named, not book 1. And I was not told how long it would take me, how I could do this.
Uh-huh.
But I accepted the mission, and that's why I'm alive. I mean, I'm alive to do that work. That's why I came back. And I'm a cop's kid. I was raised in a police station, so I use police investigative techniques as my protocol.
Uh-huh.
Some people say, well, I'm using a self-styled method, or I made it up. Uh-uh. Anybody who knows anything about police science, when they study my protocol, know that I stick with that protocol exactly.
But you
I
mean
do not
more like a scientific approach, you mean, or what?
Absolutely. It's scientific, but yet it's a little bit broader than what... Well, it's not like a double-blind study with a control group.
Yeah.
Rather, what you're doing is you're having sessions with people. You're not just interviewing them.
Uh-huh.
You're studying them. You're studying the eyes. You're studying the body. You're studying the body language. You are studying all kinds of things about the individual. Your questions are always wide open. In other words, the way Dad raised me, he was so disturbed by people who were witness to an accident, for instance.
Yeah.
Let's say there were 4 people that were witness to an accident, and each one would have a different story.
Yeah,
and it just
that.
Drove him nuts. So he was very insistent that I learn how to be an observer.
Mm-hmm.
And that when you're an observer, if you ask questions of anybody, all you can say is, like for instance in the accident, what happened to you? Or what did you see? Or what did you witness? That's
yeah.
all you can say. You can't say car until they say car. You can't say crash until they say crash.
Yeah.
You cannot bias your interview in any way. So all I would do when I was interviewing these people would simply say, what happened to you?
Uh-huh.
And the magic word was always, and? Oh, tell me more. And? and you use a lot of body language. You use
uh-huh.
a lot of facial expressions. When you're having sessions with kids, you know enough with a child that you're never above eye level. Never, never, never. That's a no-no. If you do that, they don't trust you.
Oh, okay.
So you always get down to eye level. So if you're interviewing toddlers or, you know, kids that are just recently verbal or kids that aren't very tall, you're on the floor with them.
But is it more difficult, though, to get information from younger kids, though?
No, no, not at all. Once you know how to do it, and I tell people that in detail in my book, The New Children and Near Death Experiences, in the back in one of the appendices, I go in depth about the protocol I use. So it takes about 10 minutes, maybe 15, to gain a child's trust, and then they just open up and wow. You know.
So that's what they usually say. Children are more truthful anyway.
Oh, it just comes out lickety split.
Uh-huh. They don't have the experience to be influenced that way either.
Well, the younger ones certainly. So I've done a lot of work in this area. But one of the things that interested you that I was working on way back when,
yeah,
and finally wrote a book about it, was the future memory phenomenon.
But let me ask you, did you ever have any contact with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross?
Oh, yeah. She's the one who got me started.
Because
in the sense
she was involved with the near-death experience way
yeah,
back.
Yeah, I met her in Chicago at the O'Hare Airport in July of 1978. Remember, I began my work in November of 78.
Yeah.
I met her in July, and I think it was July. Yeah, it was either July or August, but I think it was in July.
Yeah.
And her plane was late for a trip to Europe. It was over an hour late.
Uh-huh.
And I recognized her, went up to her, and asked if we could just visit. And we could. We did. We sat on a bench, just the two of us. We talked like a couple of little kids who'd known each other forever.
She was very approachable.
Yeah, and I told her about my own experiences, all three of them.
Yeah.
She listened, and she was the one who told me that I was a near-death experiencer.
Yeah.
She told me what the near-death experience was. She never mentioned Raymond Moody. She never mentioned his book.
Yeah.
And I knew nothing about Raymond Moody or his book for about another 3 years or so.
Uh-huh.
It was Kenneth Ring who told me about Raymond Moody.
Mm.
I had never heard of the guy.
Well, when I met Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, it was at a seminar she was giving, and it was in Joplin. And they had expected about 400 or 500 people at this hotel, and we went up there, and there ended up being over 1,000.
Oh, I could believe that. She was such a powerful woman.
They were totally unprepared. I mean, they didn't know what they were going to do with all these people. And they had us crammed in there as tight as you could cram them in, even extending out around the swimming pool. They had to open up the rooms for the motel rooms for the restrooms. And anyway, when she arrived, she said they almost didn't let her in because she was dressed in a T-shirt and jeans.
Right, yeah, that's our dear Elizabeth. Yeah.
I guess she didn't look like this, distinguished woman they were expecting.
Yeah,
and,
she just got up on the top of the
desk and crossed her legs and began to talk, and very down to earth and
very
natural and approachable.
Oh, yeah.
So I figured if you were in this field, you would have had to have come in contact with her.
Oh, yeah, she's the one who started me.
Uh-huh. Well,
and
then
we had many
person.
Other interactions after that.
Uh-huh. Okay,
and then one of the life-changing experiences for me was to go and attend her death and dying seminar that was in September. It started September 22nd, 1978.
This was in the 70s.
August 22nd, 1978.
Okay, I know it was in the 70s when I went to this one, and it was supposed to be for doctors and caregivers, and everybody was there.
But yeah, I went to the one in Shanti Nilaya. In Escondido, California, that was her second one that she'd ever held. And, it was through very miraculous kinds of events that I was able to get there. But I did, And
well, we know nothing is a coincidence.
And of course, that was a biggie for me. And then I began to be able to integrate my own experiences after that. And you know, took off on my own future memory episode. In other words, living the future before it occurred.
Okay,
I lived a whole year before it occurred.
Now we can get into that. Okay. But did you start doing this as a result of the near-death experience? You began seeing the future, or what? Tell us.
I'm not talking about seeing the future. That's clairvoyance. I'm talking about pre-living it.
Okay, that's what I mean.
Very different.
Could you explain what you're talking about? But it happened after the, as a result of the near-death experiences?
For me, it did.
Yeah.
For me, it did. And we now know that these kinds of episodes do occur for people. They're part of the after effects, not only of near-death experiences, but of any kind of impactful, transformational spiritual experience. Mm-hmm. So any kind of experience that really flips you around, that's a breakthrough experience, that's truly a life-changing experience that is so impactful that there's no such thing as life as always. You know, it just completely changes you.
Uh-huh. So you
the
don't
after
have
effects
to
of
you
those
don't have
kinds
to
of things is future. Among the after effects is episodes like future memory.
Yeah, so you don't actually have to die. It's just
no.
kind of a changing experience.
Right. And Ken Ring at that time, he's one of our pioneers in the field of near-death studies that came after Raymond Moody. He was talking about flash forwards, that experience afterward would get these flashes of the future.
Okay.
And I looked at that and I thought, well, that doesn't really explain it. That just doesn't cover what's going on here, Ken. And he couldn't understand me. So I started looking into it much more deeply because it had occurred to me. It was happening to many other experiencers I knew about.
Okay.
So I decided to do a particular project just on future memory. Did it happen to just people like myself, people who had these sudden spiritual experiences, these very dramatic ones, or are there other circumstances where this can occur? And I found out that a lot of people have them. People have them under people who are dealing with a lot of stress in their life, a lot of sudden changes in their life, things that they can't handle necessarily, will start to have these. Now, what they are, and I'm going to be kind of technical here, but not that technical, I hope.
Okay.
I call future memory
a
chance to pre-live the future in advance. Now, notice I said pre-live. It's the ability to fully live a given event or sequence of events in subjective reality before it plays out in objective reality. And sometimes it's forgotten by the individual, but not always. And invariably, there's a particular cue or clue or something happens afterward that brings it all back. But usually, most people remember it, but not everybody.
Uh-huh.
But this pre-happening, this pre-living is so detailed, Dolores, that there is no way to distinguish it from everyday reality while the phenomenon is in progress. In other words, everything, every detail is lived. Each movement, each thought, smell, taste, decision, sight, sound, and everything is pre-lived. It's not just a viewing like clairvoyance or a hearing like clairaudience or a knowing like precognition or a prediction, prophecy. It's not any, and it's not deja vu. People sometimes get it mixed up with deja vu. Deja vu is always past-oriented.
Yeah. Yeah.
Future memory is always having to do with a future that has not occurred.
Well, so, I mean, when it happens, how do you know you're in the future? Is there something that distinguishes it from...
Well, there's a particular pattern I found with the majority of experiencers, whether they be those who had an experience like myself, that is to say, that were turned around by these, you know, really transformational experiences,
yeah,
or people who had gone through many changes in their lives and were sort of, quote unquote, dealing with it, a lot of stress. So it didn't matter what kind of person.
Yeah.
The majority had a particular pattern, and I talk about this pattern, of course, in my book Future Memory, and I give the whole sequence of the pattern,
But the first
clue, the physical sensation at onset is almost always either a rush of heat coupled with a feeling of exhilaration, or somehow there's a lift felt or a ringing sound in people's ears, or somehow they feel themselves being exhilarated. Well, right now, Dolores, before you go any further,
yeah,
right now, you know from that, that there, the fact that there are physical sensations, that there are chemical changes occurring in the brain.
Yeah.
Right now, you know this is a physical event. This is not imagination. This is not a projection of some kind. This is
not an illness. Sorry.
You know, you're not playing games here. This is absolutely physical.
Uh-huh.
And
so the person, I mean, you could just be sitting in your house and you suddenly start having,
yeah,
these feelings.
And you know, one of the things I found, Dolores, is that these kind of events almost always, not always, but almost always happen when the person is physically engaged in life. In other words, you're not sitting on your bun dreaming, or you're not, you know, doing the usual meditative, quiet kind of thing.
Oh, sitting what?
You're walking, or you're vacuuming, or you're doing dishes, or you're engaged in some kind of activity.
Yeah.
And almost always, it involves mundane events. Once in a while, it would be a major event that the person would relive, but the majority of cases were always mundane events. Let me give you an example.
Yeah,
let me give you an example of one of my own.
Example. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. This is when my husband and I were living in Williamsburg, Virginia.
Yeah.
And let's see, what is it? Maybe 20 years ago now. Anyway, a while ago. And I was in the kitchen. He was in the dining room. He was reading the paper. He had the paper held up. And I went over to pick up the lunch dishes and turned around, was walking into the kitchen. I was holding the lunch dishes, and all of a sudden, the phone rang. We had a wall phone in the kitchen. The phone rang.
Yeah.
I went over to the phone. I answered the phone. And there was a man on the phone who had just come into town. He was the head of the promotional division of the company my husband worked for.
Yeah.
And he said, I hear you would like to join forces with us and hand out flyers and be part of our promotion on this next big sale. And I said, yes, I would like to do that. I have some time, you know, free, and I would like to, you know, just be involved in this. And he says, okay, meet us at 7 o'clock tonight at Howard Johnson's restaurant, and I'll explain all the details then.
Okay.
So I busied myself through the day, and I vacuumed, and I did all kinds of things, and I was ready at 7 o'clock. And I drove over to Howard Johnson's, parked the car, got out of the car, went inside Howard Johnson's, and went through these big, huge glass doors, went inside, couldn't find this guy.
Uh-huh.
So I turned around, and when I turned around, there he was walking in the doors surrounded by a bevy of women. bingo. And then it was over, and I'm still standing there in the kitchen, and I'm holding the luncheon dishes, and I'm wondering, what happened? This was so physical, Dolores.
It was like
slipping. I had done it.
Was it kind of like what I call slipping into another dimension and then coming back or something?
No. I was in this dimension. I knew I was in this dimension. It was 100% physical reality, and I knew it was physical, and I physically did it. And, you know, I went onto the kitchen counter. Excuse me, I put the plates down and wondered about this. Well, I guess maybe a week later, I was just walking by the kitchen and the phone rang.
Yeah.
And I answered the phone, and there was this guy who just came into town who was head of the promotional part of my husband's business. And he said, well, you know, I just got into town, and you know, I heard that you wanted to take part in handing out flyers in our new promotion for our new sale. Why don't you come to Howard Johnson's restaurant at 7 o'clock tonight? That's when we're having our meeting. I'll explain everything then.
See, that would have been the feeling of deja vu.
And then I busied myself. You know, I vacuumed the house and I did a lot of things, and I changed the clothes and I got my car and I drove to Howard Johnson's and I parked the car and I went into Howard Johnson's and I went through the big glass doors and I couldn't find the guy. And when I turned around, the whole episode returned to me. I remembered it, and I knew I had done this before. And I start, I'm not kidding you, Dolores, I'm standing there in the Howard Johnson's restaurant, and I started laughing because I knew exactly what was going to happen when I turned around.
Uh-huh.
And I just, without turning around, I just stood there, and I laughed and laughed and laughed. And finally, when I got tired of laughing, I turned around. And there's this guy, he's walking in the door surrounded by a bevy of women.
Uh-huh.
So I go running up to him, and I introduce myself to him. And I say, I can hardly wait to find out about this promotion and hand out the flyers.
Uh-huh.
Well, Dolores,
the guy went
totally white. He stepped back. His mouth fell open, and he said, how do you know who I am? I just got into town. You cannot possibly know what I look like. How do you know this? Well, Dolores, that wasn't part of my future memory episode. So I had to get really creative.
Yeah.
And I thought for a minute, and I thought, and then I said to him, lucky guess. And that's all I could say to him, lucky guess. And I just fluffed it off, and we had our meeting. But do you know, for my entire employment with this guy, and it was about a couple of weeks long, maybe 2 or 3 weeks,
yeah,
he would never touch me. He would never be close to me. He would hardly be in the same room with me unless he was on the other end of the room, because I spooked him out.
You must have freaked him out.
I did.
Probably.
I did. That's how real future memory episodes are. And some people think, well, you know, these pre-happenings, these previews, these overlays of reality enable us to prepare, to get ready for the future before it occurs.
Yeah.
And the purpose of that maybe is to experiment, maybe to change the future. In other words, we change our mind. When we pre-live it, we find out, no, I don't want to go through that, so we can change it. Well,
you know, that's what in my work we found out. There's many probabilities, possibilities.
Well, Dolores, what I found out was just the opposite. Let me give you an example.
But the main thing is you didn't remember it until you were going through it.
I didn't that one. The others?
You didn't come back to you until you experienced it.
That was true in that one.
Yeah,
that was not true in the others that I had. That is not true with all of the other people I had sessions with.
Yeah.
It was true with some. It was not true with all. Now, let me share with you a woman in the state of Washington. She was just walking through her living room, and she had one of these future memory episodes where she pre-lived her husband coming home and saying that he had a meeting he had to go to. He didn't know about this meeting in advance. He had to go to this meeting, and he left, went to the meeting. There was a serious car accident, and he totaled the car. And that so freaked her out that she became very, very hyper alert.
Mm.
Well, when her husband came home several hours later, and he said to her, "Well, there's been a sudden meeting that's called. I'm going to have to go to it." She intervened. She said, "Oh, well, I'd like to drive." So she intervened in the event. She drove him to the meeting. She drove him home. There was no accident. And she breathed a sigh of relief. By intervening, she was able to turn it around.
See, that's what I mean. There.
Dolores, hold on. A couple of days later, same week, another sudden meeting turned up. This time he didn't tell his wife. He went to it. There was a serious accident, and he totaled the car.
So it was meant to be.
Her intervention only delayed the episode. It did not stop it.
All right, yeah.
Now, hold on just a minute here. Let me tell you a little bit about some of the other things I noticed, and then let's go for the big one.
Okay, you're talking, you're reminding me of an incident that happened in my family. I didn't know what it was. We just chalked it up to one of the weird things that happened.
I think a lot of your audience is going to click here.
But you want me to tell this one real quickly before you get into the big one?
Tell yours? Sure.
Okay, because you just reminded me. It was so weird. But it was my daughter, and she was asleep. And her teenage daughter was in the bathroom, you know, taking a shower and getting ready to go to bed. And she was asleep, and she thought she was having a dream. Her daughter came running into the room, you know, crying and hollering, totally naked. And she said she was cutting her toenails, and she cut her toe, and it was bleeding. Well, you know, and anyway, then it was like that was the end of it. And my daughter was saying, "Wow, what a weird dream." And she rolled over, and then the next instant, here she really came running into the room. It was like it was repeating itself.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought maybe she just saw it before it happened or something.
Well, some people do have them in the dream state or the alpha state, but most people have these episodes when they're wide awake.
But she didn't know what to call it, just a weird thing, you know?
Yeah, well, most people don't. Are not
so
familiar
now,
with
now
the term future memory, and most people haven't read my book, Future Memory.
Yeah, so we'll have to tell her, now you were just having a future memory.
She was having a future memory episode.
Now, go on with your example.
Yeah, Dolores, when I ask these people, why do you suppose future memory episodes occur? Invariably, they would call them pre-happenings or previews.
Yeah.
That enable them to see ahead and give extra time to prepare themselves. Some people call them advanced practice sessions and living.
Yeah.
Some people call them a chance to experiment with other possibilities in living. Some people call them a window into their future. But what I noticed when I really dug deeper is that most people felt that future memory episodes enriched and enlivened their life while imparting a sense of purpose and meaning. They regarded it as a gentle nudge to help them live life more sensibly and more responsibly. It reestablished a natural rhythm to how their lives unfolded. In other words, kind of like a flow state. It left them with a keen sense that each person and each activity matters, no matter who you are and what you are. Well, that's all well and good, except that it didn't satisfy me. And I really didn't make the connection to what I think is really going on here until I started studying brain development in children. And that's when I hit pay dirt. Children in the process of temporal lobe development. Now, you know, your temporal lobes are that section of the brain at or near the temples on each side of your brain.
The head.
You know,
okay.
Each side of your head. Those are your temporal lobes.
Part of the brain, what does that part represent? What activity?
Well, they're like the libraries of the brain. That's where you have... is stored all the shapes, sounds, all the stuff of life is stored there. It's your incredible libraries. It's called the imagination center.
Okay.
You know, we can go on with all kinds of terms about what the temporal lobes are, and they're located at or near the temples.
Okay.
So the temporal lobes. A child by the age of 4 is almost entirely future-oriented. They are so attuned to the future that he or she will spend most of their waking hours projecting into the future, living events before they occur, practicing about future events, encounters in advance. That's what they're doing. You look at kids between the ages of about 3 to 5. This is when the temporal lobe development is, or most of it is. And that's what they're doing.
But they don't have any way to communicate that because they wouldn't understand it.
It's one of the major ways a child has to explore and practice living. In other words, you cannot progress through the earth plane without a sense of future. It's what gives you continuity and contrast. So that's what these kids are doing.
You have to have a contact with your past to function in today, you know, in a normal world. But do you think it also has to do with the future?
I think future is absolutely essential. When I started looking at actual brain development in kids from 3 to 5, they pre-live the future on a regular basis. They spend more time in the future than in the present. They play with futuristic possibilities as a way of getting ready. This enables them to rehearse. They have no natural understanding of time, space, states.
Uh-huh.
So they consider future an aspect of now.
Okay.
That's how they gain perspective and continuity. The idea of continuous scenery and connected wholes, it's all from these future memory practices or rehearsals that they have. Well, my dear Dolores, hold on to your hat. In my research of near-death experiencers and other people so impacted by other transformational events, they invariably started remembering the future before it occurred, either through future memory episodes or other types of futuristic abilities, like clairaudience or what have you. In other words, tuning into the future is part of the after effects of these kinds of experiences. Well, when I looked at that, when I looked at how it was happening, I made the connection. When we have undergone a major transformational event, it doesn't matter how it happened, we automatically revert to the same behavior patterning as children do between the ages of about 3 to 5, and I believe for the same purpose. With adult experiencers, we often pre-live the future on a regular basis through different kinds of dream episodes, visions, future memory episodes.
Yeah.
We pre-experience life's challenges and opportunities before they occur as a way of preparing to meet futuristic demands. We are no longer restricted by a sense of time-space dates. We have more of an awareness of simultaneity and the importance of now. We're starting to embrace broader dimensions of future. With the kids, it's the development of the temporal lobes. With the adults, it's the expansion of the temporal lobes. With the kids, it's the birth of imagination. That's what scientists call this time frame. I believe with adults, it is the rebirth of imagination. In other words, future memory episodes are a signal that the brain is developing, evolving, moving into higher states of consciousness. I believe it is a signal of the development of the higher brain, so more and more of the higher mind can be accessed. Again, I say to you, we cannot progress through earth plane living without a sense of future, because that's where continuity comes from. That's where contrast comes from. We can't recognize anything without contrast. That's where perspective comes from. We need that in order to appreciate past. We must have an awareness of future.
But, you know, as we know, the future is not set in stone. So, you know, there are these different probabilities. And
that's when you're getting into altered states of consciousness. That's
yeah.
when you're getting into psychic abilities.
Yeah.
That's when you're getting into other ways of using faculties normal to us. When we're talking about psychic abilities, what we're really talking about is expansions of faculties normal to us. So I'm not talking here about faculty perception.
Okay.
I'm talking about brain development, which I think is so exciting, at least to me, and I hope your listenership too, that these kinds of incredible events that happen to us that turn us around and enable faculties to expand. These kinds of transformational events are natural and normal and necessary and part of the evolution of the species. They're happening more and more. They need to happen more and more. And if you get into my book, Beyond the Indigo Children, I get very deeply into the evolution of the species, which I believe is happening right now. We're making that quantum leap as a species
I've written about in my new book, Convoluted Universe, is the same thing, that we are evolving. It's as though the vibrations, the frequencies are speeding up. And I've been told we are bringing back psychic abilities that were lost, and we need them now to survive, and that we are evolving. And as a race, we're evolving into a whole new dimension.
And my job as a researcher is to track that, to pinpoint that, to observe that, to be able to show how it's happening and why it's happening.
But see, that way you're able to look at it scientifically and with the medical, the physical, to be explained it in that way.
That's my job. That's what I came back for. Remember what I was told. It said test revelation.
Uh-huh. Okay, because I just write what I find.
Right.
But you're going back.
But see, I don't.
Back to actual proof.
I'm a field worker.
Of what is actually happening with the physical body.
A lot of people call me the gumshoe of near death. You know, I'm the gumshoe person. Yeah, I'm a field worker.
Uh-huh.
I'm out there observing and testing, having sessions with significant others as well as the experiencer themselves, testing it again and again with different populations and different parts of the country and in other countries, testing it again in sessions with significant others. In other words, it's not enough that a channeler or a psychic or a person under hypnosis says these incredible things and these incredible words and tells us and gives us this information. For me, it's is it real? Can I isolate it?
Okay.
Can I describe it? Is there an underlying purpose here? Is there underlying energies here?
See, you're going at it more for, as a scientist in that way.
Yeah. Well, hey, what guides me is the words of the physicist Wolfgang Pauli. His name's kind of hard for me to say, but anyway, Wolfgang Pauli.
Yeah.
When he said, and I quote, "We need a new science to explore the objective side of human consciousness and the subjective side of matter, not mysticism, but a science willing to incorporate objective and subjective avenues to discovery while recognizing the legitimacy of personal experience," end of quote.
Yeah, but that's where you have to be objective, which is difficult because, you know, it is bordering on the psychic.
That's the new science.
Yeah.
That's the new science.
Uh-huh.
And I consider myself to be one of the new scientists.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I consider you to be that too. You know, when I give lectures on in my near-death experiences, well, in mine is not the near-death. Mine is goes beyond that, too, the real death experiences I've discovered through hypnosis. But when I'm doing a lecture on that, I always ask the audience, is there anyone in the audience that has had a near-death experience? And there will usually be at least three or four people raise their hands, no matter what country in the world I'm at.
Right.
And then I ask them different questions, and invariably the experience is the same.
Well, the pattern is the same.
But, you know, the skeptics, you've heard the skeptics, they're always saying, oh, it has to do with medication.
My dear, there is not one single skeptical objection that has not been overturned through scientific research.
Yeah, you know, we know it's real, but they come up with these really absurd explanations that it has to do with, you know, the oxygen deprivation.
Well,
when a person is
we've
dying,
already
all
proved
kinds.
All of that to be false. I'm now in the process of rewriting and updating the complete Idiot's Guide to Near-Death Experiences. Yes, I wrote an idiot's book.
You said it's not a very good title, but
only the new one will not have the idiot's name in the title. I'm getting rid of that title. I didn't have any choice before. I do now.
Yeah.
And it's literally an encyclopedia of the entire field.
Oh,
so
okay.
Anybody who can get a hold of the old one, the original one,
yeah,
the Complete Idiot's Guide to Near-Death Experiences, they will have a complete encyclopedia of the entire field. Well, now it's going to be even more complete.
Mm.
And now we have so much more verified research than we had even back in the year 2000 when the book came out.
Uh-huh.
Just in the 6 years.
I think the
new information is so exciting.
That's why I think what we are trying to do is to present enough information that maybe the skeptics will be turned around, the scientists and like that, because I always figure in a scientific experiment, they repeat something over and over and over again before they declare that it's valid. What's the difference between that and the kind of work that I do where I have the same results over and over and over again? That, to me, is scientific evidence.
HTTP, what is it, a colon, /// pmhoutwater.blogspot.com. Can you imagine? I'm now a blogger.
Oh, okay, because I was going to ask how people can contact you, but you've already given out your website.
Yeah, the website, www.pmhoutwater.com.
And would they be able to communicate with you through that?
Well, I discourage too much of that because I could get hundreds of those emails, and you know you can't answer them all.
But yes,
you can reach me through the website.
Okay, I'm the same way. Mine pile up, and I apologize.
I'm working on another book now, and I'm just being real with people and saying, you know, I don't have much time anymore for email. I just don't.
Well, it's the same way with snail mail. I tell them I will do it if I can, but it just seems to be too much.
Yeah, I do what I can.
We're coming to where we're going to have to sign off, and I just want to tell people again, my website is OzarkMountain.com, the name of my company. It's OzarkMT.com.
And to all the listeners, my goodness, Dolores has written incredible books. You ought to get some.
And we're old friends anyway. I like to have people on the show that I know real well.
Okay.
All right. Well, I think it's going to be about time to sign off then. And thanks a lot for coming on.
Well, thank you for the privilege and the pleasure.
And we'll
many blessings, dear.
We'll do it again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.